Welcome back, thinkers. That's right, I haven't gone anywhere. Well, I did just for a month or so. But yeah, we are still making episodes, or at least trying to. No big news other than apologies for taking so long between episodes. If you're still listening to the show, thank you very much. Your listens are still very, very much appreciated. The only other thing to add is since this last episode aired, I am now the official DM for the current campaign of the Dungeons, Dice and Dudes actual play podcast and stream. So you've heard me talk about them before. Now I am DMing. My Quinn days are behind me and I'm now running the show. Nathan has graciously stepped aside to allow me to sit in the DM's chair. We are running through my Rayandor campaign. So if you want to see me be a DM in a semi quote-unquote professional setting, check the links in the description or go to ddndpod on any of the social media platforms or search for Dungeons, Dice and Dudes. Otherwise, we're just going to get cracking straight in to this week's episode. And today I'm joined by Austin, who goes under AC Wickham. Thank you ever so much for joining us today, Austin. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've been playing D&D for about the last 7 years with the same sort of group of people. We started off with like 10 of us, and now we've moved down to a more manageable 6, which has made my life a lot easier. So yeah, we're currently running our third campaign, which is in the same world, but just moving different locations where everything gets affected by the previous one. Other than that, I've written a couple of D&D one-shots. I've done a handful of Call of Cthulhu bits and pieces as well. I've recently published my first book, Dead Surprise, which is based on my D&D campaigns and the characters and plots. And I'm sure that's going to come up a few more times as we go through this anyway.
Amazing. So is that on like DM's Guild or...?
So the book at the moment, you can get it in Waterstones and Amazon.
Amazing.
A couple of tabletop shops locally to me. Oh, Cool Merchandise in Southampton actually are stocking it too.
Oh, amazing.
But so yeah, I'm hoping to sort of try and branch out a bit further as more time goes on. But at the moment, I've been writing the second one and I've just finished that. So now all my energy is going into editing that for the moment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the fun of editing. Yeah. Awesome. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us today, the topic of which is translation. So what does that mean to you in the D&D and wider TTRPG framework?
So when I think of translation, I think of how something translates from a thing that comes into my head onto my notes and paper, and then how that further translates into the game at large. So, you know, like there's this, I woke up in a cold sweat the other night at like 2 a.m. and wrote down Loudancer on a scratch pad next to my table. And then was like, what on earth have I done? But then I thought about, okay, well, how would that make an interesting item or feature to have in the game? How can I take this idea of the inverse of a silencer and make it something usable? And then how does that then become something that the players actually find an interest or a use for? So that's sort of the you know, just a general idea of how I think of that word.
Okay, so let's pull at that thread then, because obviously this, as with all the topics on thinking critically, it could be taken in any number of ways, but let's start with that thread then, and having gone through, I guess, the most extreme end-to-end of that process yourself, from I've got an idea to it's now physically on paper in a shop, it's like, there's no more, yeah. that is cradle to grave. So take us through that process then, because I know most DMs, myself included, you have that thought process and then sometimes it can be so quick that it's in the game. You know, you've had that thought and then it's already coming out of your mouth and it's in the game. For better or for worse, it's now in the hands of the players. And that cycle is very short, very...
Leaving something in the hands of the players.
Yeah. Do that as little as possible. DM tip number one. But obviously from... I'm struggling to find the word, not professional, but I mean it is certainly, but more formalized process, shall we say, from that initial conception all the way to the end. Take us through that and let's focus on maybe the key differences from, wouldn't it be funny if there was a banana skin on the floor that the players tripped up on?
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? Actually, that's not a bad idea for just a straight trap. Like, you know, to change it for a second, there was a fantastic one I saw called the bear trap, which is, it's just an ordinary bear trap on the ground. Mm-hmm. But when you open it back up to get your leg out of it, it just spawns an angry bear nearby. But yeah, I mean, in terms of taking this from an initial idea to, I mean, for the way that I run my games is always very narrative and character driven. So it's always what they're doing to affect things that are going on. So usually I think more in terms of that line of, like, okay, well, here's a cool idea, but is this something that someone's actually going to find use for? Or is this just something that I'm going to give to them? And it's just going to sit around forgotten at the bottom of a bag holding for the entirety of the campaign or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we did have a fairy gunslinger as she was an artificer who also used pistols. And because of her being a fairy character, her thing was always about trying to be the loudest person in the room. which is where I then tailored that to be. It became an attachment to her guns that could deal thunder damage to anyone nearby, but only once.
Yeah.
Which I just thought, you know, what an extra way of just her announcing her presence every time she comes in.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's now something that's just going to sit around and do nothing for the moment. Mm. But yeah, it's that kind of idea. I mean, it's not even like I think of Brian Sanderson's Mistborn series of books.
Right.
He's got the protagonists and the special characters in that can burn metals, that they call it, to give themselves additional powers like strength or speed or this, that, or the other. And I've recently read through the first trilogy of that again, and I thought, again, what a fantastic idea. Like, you have something that you could, I think what I made is it's a pewter bracelet, and you can sacrifice some of your strength score into it to call upon it at a later date. So you're going to spend like 12 hours, like zero to your strength score, but then later on you can have an additional +2 on top of what you'd already have. Mm-hmm. So it's very situational. It's something that you'd have to prepare for in advance. But, you know, I feel like it's quite an interesting sort of mechanic that someone could choose to do that. Like, if you're doing a long dungeon crawl stuck in the Underdark for maybe a week at a time, do you run the risk of sacrificing that now? Or do you, you know, how does that work out well?
Mm-hmm. That risk and reward is something that I love in both when I play video games, that Dark Souls of do you want to spend 30 seconds chucking on that Estus flask, but then you're walking around unable to defend yourself? Like, it's that design choice is always interesting, and it's the same for D&D. And I've got a player who that frustrates a lot, because they were creeping in through a tunnel into a wider cave chamber that had a bunch of cultists in recently. And I was like, okay, with that roll, you can get a decent view into the cave. And he's like, oh, could I go any further to get a better look in the cave? I was like, well, certainly you could just walk straight in, but like, your stealth roll has to be like 50 at that point. So you could try, but, and the reward is you get a good view of the room, but the risk is they're going to see you. So it's entirely up to you. And he's like, damn you, DM. And I'm like, you can't just walk around.
How dare you play it by the rules?
So yeah, that giving the players those options is one of my favorite things.
I mean, have you got any like quirky items like that that seem very sort of situational or weird that you've peppered into your games, or that you just know about that you want to use?
So with these guys who we play the game, I think it's, you know, a way to blow off steam, and it's sometimes quite few and far between sessions, and D&D isn't their like number one hobby. So when we started, I did have various ideas for various interesting items and a couple of the stuff in Xanathar's, which are more flashy, like cape billowing and the cane that turns into a sword, you know, kind of like just little tweaks to stuff, which I love. I try to get a cape billowing in all my characters. but I think through play, it became apparent that, and it's, you mentioned it earlier on about a bag of holding full of items. They were pretending to be prisoners. They took off all their armor, put it in the bag of holding. And when they got through and they were taking them out again, they were like, oh, there's probably so much stuff in here, we just don't know anymore. And we went through a joke of them like pulling out, you know, rabbits out of a hat and like just various artifacts from legends gone by that they've forgotten about. So we don't tend to do too much of that stuff. A couple of them are more, you know, min-maxed, focused, and are like, okay, I'll wear that armor because it's objectively better, and I'll wear the 9 life stealer because it's awesome, but everything else, well, I take it or leave it, really. Chuck it, some little stone that shows me the way home, chuck that in the bag. So no, I did, one item I did make was they helped some refugees. It's very early on in the campaign. I thought a nice little stone they could have, kind of like a hearth stone from WoW, but it would always point to some location you designated home.
Yeah.
You know, no matter where you are, what plane you're on, if you use it, it will say, okay, you've set this in as your home, and it will help you get there, basically, because you help these refugees return home. I thought that was a quaint little, like a nice little memory for that adventure. But
maybe I was being a naive newbie DM, but adventurers never want to go home. They want to go out on adventures. So.
Yeah, sure. I gave my players an item called the Ring of Leading, which would lead them to a certain objective, whatever they designated. And then I put them in a maze, which was pitch black in there. And they went, well, the Ring of Leading will just lead us to the exit. We'll just go straight through it. And I didn't have a good response for that. I was like, oh, yeah, that was a bad decision to have given you that.
That is DMing 101. I don't think there's a DM that's ever played run a game that hasn't had exactly that, or a very similar thought process of, oh, I didn't think that would completely trivialize that encounter, but it's happened now, so that's life. So no, I don't have too many, and that particular Blood Hunter barbarian who is very, is there a mechanical benefit to this, yes or no, then I don't care too much about it. He was, I think it's fair to say, very against the idea of getting rid of all his armor and weapons to pretend to be a prisoner. He's like, well, we're all dead. We're all just going to die if we do that. So I just want to make it very clear that I'm against this plan because I don't want to take off my armor because it's everything. And I said, you know, if we're nothing without the armor, then you don't deserve it, and so on and so on. And but yeah, so it's give me weapons. They got a crown, a gem of brilliance or something, where there's different gems in it that cast different spells that they get a lot of use out of. Bag of tricks, where you throw out a little fluffy ball and it turns into a random creature. They get quite a lot of, annoyingly for a DM's point of view, a lot of mileage out of that, because then I have to scrabble around to find the stat block. Giant emu, dust off the pages of that DM's guide that I'd never use. It's like, oh, okay, this creature's now on the board. Do I have a token for that? No, unsurprisingly. So that's my ongoing thorn in my side. And it's like that meme of I'm wearing the mask. I'm like, oh, cool, yeah, you're using your item,
yeah,
but
great.
Behind the Brian. Yeah. Don't make me do this. So no, it's unfortunately nothing too wild for me. Although the other game I'm running, they're still in their like prologue baby steps phase. So once they're out of that, then I might try and test the waters with them and see if there's some more outlandish stuff for them. But have you had to, in that process of translating it from your game to the written page, have you, you know, you've got the opportunity there to take a really critical look at stuff, and have you ever gone, oh, okay, with the, you know, the clarity of daytime, that's I need to wildly change this item or this set piece or this encounter?
Yeah, there's been a couple times where I've done that. Usually it comes the 3 hours before a session. We go back over my notes. So I'm just going to prepare myself and look at it. Oh no, 4 adult dragons, sir. That's not going
to
work.
I need to double it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. They can always run away. They don't have to fight them. I don't know if that's ever been true of any D&D player to see a fight and think we can just run away. I don't know if anyone's ever had that thought, but it's you know, possible.
It exists on paper.
Yeah. No, I mean, our first campaign, like, you know, when I was starting to get to grips with it all, there was a couple of items that I made, and then very quickly realized, oh no, this is actually making things harder for me, because now it's they're getting through enemies too quickly, or they're healing too fast, or something like that. And now the balance is off for this one player, as opposed to everyone else. He can get through everything, no issue whatsoever, and everyone else is struggling. So, so there's been a couple of times where I've had to rejig that. But I mean, as you said earlier about you know, you've got this min-max player, and I think I've got quite a good balance of. Some people min-max and some people just there for RP with bad stats. And you do get stuck in that hole of, okay, it's going to be challenging enough for them, but not so challenging that's going to take them off the board. But I mean, we're still only early days with this campaign. But I think now we've all known each other quite well as friends and now quite well as D&D players. So everyone's got quite a good understanding of what role they should be fulfilling.
Yes, I love that rapport that you build is great. And like when I sit down now with these guys, I know exactly the kind of, you know, how the next couple of hours are going to take, and you know how that's going to feel and play and stuff. And it is, we have a player who is very much like myself, a slave to the story first, and then whatever happens to his character or whatnot, he's like, well, that's what's happened. And that's how I tend to run my characters as well, much to the surprise of some other players I'm with, who are like, but you're going to die if you do that. Well, that's
just what my character,
the story, like that's how the story has led us to this point. So it's sometimes funny to see that those two interact, because he's like, well, I'm just going to do this thing. And the min-maxer is like, well, don't do that because that's an objectively foolish idea from a player's point of view. He's like, oh yeah, no, I'm fully aware of that. But his character actually ran away to, hit a cubic gate. So he disappeared off to Shadowfell because from his character's point of view, the rest of the party betrayed him. Now that isn't technically what happened. So he's like, well, I'm just going to chill out on the Shadowfell for however many weeks and then I'll roll the new character. So he's, and everyone's like, oh, okay, we've lost Kalor. Okay, fine. Didn't expect that to happen from our plan, but moving on. So now he's playing someone else, and it's interesting. It's always interesting. That's the most important thing, and fun, of course, to have all these interactions between players. But here's my process. Let's start from there.
Yeah, so
I've put a lot of effort into making several kind of standalone, discrete chapters or arcs, how you want to do them, and then the way I run the campaign is they get plugged in when the players choose to go down that path. And I've run it, or several of them, a number of times with different groups. So the current campaign I'm running on the stream is third iteration, so they're hopefully getting a refined version. And so through that process, as I said, I've kind of pared it down. I've cut away the chaff bits. I've highlighted the bits that people found more fun and stuff. So I like to think they're getting a very nice refined version of it. Now, I know that is very fortunate for me to have had the opportunity to run through the game like twice before, the third group of players get to play it. Often it's, as I said earlier, it's just, I pulled this out of a hat and it's happening. So and we'll just learn together if this is going to work or not. One of those chapters arcs, I was like, I'm really proud of this one. The players really enjoyed it. It has a nice beginning, middle of end. Let me start to write it down. And that has, as many creative activities have done, has just gone and started to gather dust in my hard drive as this Word document that's never been finished, because I found it a drastically different experience to being like, oh, I can't just make stuff up. Like, I have to describe how this place looks. I can't just improvise it on the spot because somebody else needs this information now. On the one hand, I was proud of that I can improvise my way through stuff. I was like, hey, that's one of my stronger elements of being a DM. And on the other hand, I was like, this is an awful lot more work than I was anticipating. So translating something from even something I've run through twice to something on pen and paper was a very different experience for me. So how did you find that?
Do you know what, interestingly much the same. I've got an A-level in theater and media studies, so whenever I picture stuff, it's always from an audience perspective, and I'm quite good with my descriptions and things like that. But yeah, whenever I'm describing a scene, it's like a two paragraph scene going into perhaps too much detail.
Yeah.
Or it's the opposite, where it's a sudden thing and I wasn't prepared for it, and I'll give a very vague description, and then someone will say, oh, I want to do something. Also, here's this thing, because again, I've got it. I know it so well in my head. My wife is telling me this all the time. It's like, no one else is privy to the conversation you're having in your own head. You need to tell us what's going on. You can't just start a sentence halfway through and expect everyone to be there.
Yeah. No, I'm laughing because the amount of conversations I've had with my partner where I'll just randomly start talking about something else, and she's like, sorry, I don't know what you're talking about now. And I go,
exactly.
Sorry, let me explain to you the four leaps I took in my head in the fraction of a second that took me from cooking bacon to fighting dragons. So boom, 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 boom. So anyway, about this red dragon. She's like, okay, thanks for filling those logical leaps for me.
Yeah. So I'm in the exact same boat.
I found when writing, maybe a more reactive improvisational DM. So when people want to try stuff or ask, like you said, is there a barrel in the room that I can hide in off the top of my head? And then suddenly now this room is populated with barrels. It wasn't there before. So I found trying to walk that line between putting in checks for the players to do. And, hands up, I'm very unfamiliar with written adventures and written modules. So maybe I've got no, frame of reference there, but trying to be cater for every single check. Was like, do I want, where's the line in the sand? I don't know. Is this going to be too much? Is it going to be too handholdy? Is this not leaving enough to the eventual DM that may run this? I don't know. Have you got any thoughts or advice on that kind of stuff?
I think it's very much depending on your party. So I mean, like, as your players, that rather. So like my group is very, we want to follow the story and we're just playing in the world and we'll do what our character's going to do, but we're not going to go off the rails and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But then you get some groups who, you know, they're all sort of yes and they build it all together. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that it really is dependent on, you could be vague with the details if you know your players are going to fill in some extras for yourself. So I think for myself, I don't do myself any favors because I build such a detailed, rich world mm-hmm. that my players almost... It's not that they don't feel that they can, but they don't want to step on the toes too much, which is fine. And I get sometimes I do appreciate that. But yeah, I think there needs to be some more give and take for that scenario, just so that they feel that they have their own mark on it. You know, so I mean, like, I make sure like I build in backstory stuff and drop in characters for them to interact with and things like that. But I mean, yeah, I suppose it does depend on what your players are like in terms of how much you fill in stuff and how much you let them fill in the other details.
One of the beauties of the game for me is that bridging, you know, bringing people together to play the same game, as it were. And by that I mean like about stepping on people's toes. That I use that saying all the time, and it is such an important piece of both playing and running games, of that knowledge of, you know, someone's done something here or trying to do something, so let me help with what they're trying to achieve here, and where that line is between like, now they're taking the piss or doing something that's like not okay. And then you know working out, navigating those seas, obviously gets a lot easier than the group kind of gels.
Yeah, the better the group knows each other, the easier that sort of thing is. But yeah, I mean, you're right, you know, it's letting players have their own agency, but not letting that agency ruin someone else's agency, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's take us through then. You've got a cool idea for an encounter or a story or a chapter or whatever it may be. How do you go through that creative process of from one word or from wouldn't it be cool if to I'm playing it in a game?
Yeah. So Joe, the arc they're sort of doing at the moment started off with this idea of, What if you had a null body that was being controlled via crystal ball by a witch somewhere who's just messing with the players in the forest, mm-hmm. and just started building bits and pieces from there? So I was like, okay, well, you know, let's make this forest creepy and let's add in arcane symbols. Okay, well, let's make those arcane symbols give them some negative effects if they stare at them too long, because that's also fun. Why are they going to this forest in the first place? And you know, so that's how I started with that, is wouldn't that be a cool encounter? And then backtrack to that as, okay, why would they go here? I mean, they're working at the moment for this country as sort of as military contractors, I suppose, to just keep things in check whilst the army's off doing other stuff. So, okay, well, there's a squad that's gone missing. Let's go and investigate what's happened here. And everything just spirals down from there. And then there's someone who does, I think they call it a three encounter rule. And you have like three big encounters that are taxing, but they're not mm-hmm. overly bad. And then you pepper a few other little bits and pieces throughout. That's kind of the sort of rule I go to. So, you know, there was an initial encounter with some bandits, which was fine. Then they got attacked by some snakes and some spiders. Then the actual undead gnolls appear. And mm-hmm. But, you know, the snakes and spiders aren't going to take them down. It's burning up their resources a little bit. And then I sort of, once I've got all these bits and pieces, I try and put them in an order of how things are going to run from there. Mm-hmm. So all of that makes sense.
There's several things I wanted to talk about. That I think I'm not very good at as a DM is, obviously you have that omniscience of what the future encounters could be for the party. So when people are like spaffing two spell slots on what should be a trivial encounter, I find it very hard to be like, are you sure you want to do that? Because there might be something difficult coming up soon. Whereas at the player, I love those being like, do I want to do, you know, like Ice Storm or Fireball, or should I just cantrip again? Like, that's obviously a very interesting decision to make from a player's point of view. And yeah, having that visibility of future encounters is always like my guys are literally about to fight a dragon. I'm hoping that they'll have done that before this episode goes out.
Yeah, I know I'm being cautious with what I say in case my players haven't listened.
And they are not at 100% rested. So I'm dubious as to how well that fight is going to go, because they did, I think Wizard did both alter self and disguise self to make him change his race and what clothes he's wearing. I was like, you're going to spend both those spell slots? Yeah. I'm just sneaking past some cultists. Yeah, cool. Okay. No, we're done. But from as a DM's perspective, what was really nice, again, from experience, from being a player, you know the value of that that resource that that player has expended. So from a DM's point of view, it's really nice to be able to adjust the encounter accordingly. So I know that was quite quote-unquote expensive. So I was like, you know what? It's going to work pretty well. Like he's spent a lot to try and get the party through this area. It would be so dickish of me to be like, oh, the guards sees you through disguise and that's it and you've wasted it, because that's going to feel crap. So from it's nice to be like, okay, I'll get him to roll a few performance checks, a few, you know, deception checks, keep the tension there, and if you roll a one, then things are going to get a bit spicy.
That's to go back to what we were saying earlier about rereading over notes and adjusting the counters as you sort of come up to the sessions. We did this arc over like 3 or 4 sessions, and yeah, it was a case of so I think after the first session, they'd charmed a snake, which one of them could speak to, and was just helping them guide them through the forest. Like, okay, well, I'm going to put in some notes for the next session about this snake then. I also know one of them went down, so let's take a couple of these goons out so they've got a bit extra buffer.
Fight chance, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the sentence, charmed a snake that one of them can talk to, is brilliant. That'll be the snippet of this episode.
I was like, it's just a snake. You could just kill it. And they went, but while I do that, I can talk to him. Yeah, I guess you can.
So yeah, I love that dynamic response to players. And that ended up being like fantastic. I said to them, I was like, behind the screen, I don't often like to share my thought process behind the screen, but this one I have to tell you, I honestly sat down today and thought, you're going to see a bunch of cultists, you're going to fight them, you clear out the room, and then I'll call the session there, because that'll be nice at a time to call it.
Sure.
And instead they stuck apart. I got the monk crawling on the ceiling like Gollum, doing scouting, the three of you disguising your way through. I was like, that completely did not go how I want, but I'm very glad it went that way.
Surprised with that.
So yeah, it's a lot of refinement, I guess, for me at least, through both reviewing it ahead of time and dynamically during the session.
That's all part of the fun as a DM, reanalyzing, re-preparing, changing, tweaking on the fly to make sure that everything fits in well for everyone.
And the other thing I wanted to discuss, and it's something that the reason why I posed the question in the way I did, which was, how do you go from I've got a cool idea to then like trying to plug that square peg into the round hole of the campaign is tricky sometimes. I've taken some, you know, creative license with locations or like, you know, geographic formations that frankly would never exist in the real, like, physics as we know it. There's a big cliff here because that's how
that's dramatic.
The plates have worked in this world. But yeah, how do you do that then from, you know, because I hate to waste a cool idea. So if I've got one, it's going to find its way in. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point in the campaign, I'll try and squeeze it in. And if that means that suddenly Duergar are now a part of this world, then that's a problem for future Danlo, for Danlo tomorrow. Are you the same? What are your tips and tricks for like bringing in cool ideas?
Yeah, I suppose that is it's a tough one. It's just finding a way that makes them work. I do know what, I mean, much in a similar way. When we did our campaign too, I said there are just no Warforged. I just didn't want to have that as being part of it because they weren't in campaign one and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And then I was also like, but actually this would be a really interesting dynamic because the way that the culture is set at the moment in that land, orcs are just actively hated and hunted down, and one of the players is an orc who's got a writ saying that they're allowed to just exist. And I thought, well, let's bring in another interesting dynamic. Let's bring in a race of people who aren't actual people, as it were, and do that. And I made that part of like a whole end arc just for the sake of having like a couple sessions of players having to deal with the fallout of that.
Yeah,
but you're right. I do all of my notes for everything on OneNote, and I've just got one page which is just ideas ? And it's just every single page is just listed there with the what if they came across a young dragon who's just trying to build a nest for himself and they don't have to kill him. See how we can work that in there somehow.
I also have a page of like ideas thrown down that some are just like someone's name, like that sounds like a cool name, let me find somebody to use that.
When you're like sort of planning your sessions and coming up with new ideas and items and things like that, how much into the mechanics do you dive into like balancing for it? Do you just go, I want it to be able to do this and it's going to do this much damage? Or do you like find something similar and then try and match it up? Or do you not do any of that?
A little column A and a little column B. So yeah. My big thing, which is contradicting stuff I said earlier on, but I like most stuff to be congruent in the world. Like it makes sense. I'm not a fan of random encounter tables. You're traveling down, let me roll. Oh, suddenly a flock of seagulls are attacking you, and now we roll initiative again. That just slows down the campaign, slows down getting to speak to the mayor, slows down fighting the leader of the bandits because some seagulls are now attacking you. So I don't tend to use that. And I did pre-warn the guys for this game. I was like, it's probably going to be less combat than you're used to because I don't do that. But every combat you get means something.
I mean, the trouble with random encounters like that is they're never going to be bad enough to actually kill the players. Mm-hmm. And usually they still have travel time to regain everything. So you're not gaining much by stopping the whole thing for it. I'm much the same. I just don't do them unless I want to impart some sort of wisdom to them along the way from a friendly NPC. Mm. But that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything has to serve a greater purpose. And I never thought of it before, but that's absolutely true in that there's like no net change to the party before or after that track. Like they left the city 100%. They arrived at the next city 100%. Maybe there was a cool encounter on the way, but there's been no impact. Whereas if you're going through a dungeon, there is a change because the next fight they have, which is imminent, they've got less health to do so. So I don't tend to use... They haven't gone into any decrepit millennia-old crypts that are full of traps that are half broken because they just haven't gone there yet, which means that most of the dungeons they've been in don't have random swinging traps or anything because this was a disused hospital. So why would there be
traps?
Yeah. Swinging blades here. So I have to get creative in that sense to try and keep those things still engaging in a way that is still fun to play D&D, basically, without it just being an empty space that they're moving through. So that's traps and that kind of stuff. Combat is way more an art than it is a science, certainly in D&D 5e. So for combat encounters, it takes longer to put together than... It's probably the longest thing it takes for me to get right ahead of time because I have to review the stat block of everything I use. And what is officially easy is actually going to be actually quite hard or vice versa. Or yes, there's one big guy that on his own is a medium encounter and I've added two minions that technically pushes that into deadly, but those minions are like trash. So I can actually add like 50 minions and it still be just as hard or easy as it was before.
I've made that mistake so many times. So if one big bad guy and they just get dicked on immediately for two rounds and that's it, it's done. And I was like, cool, well, that was a fun, engaging boss fight for everyone. I'm glad that none of you took damage. Cool, that's okay.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, precisely. So I need to, thankfully, harken back to what we were just talking about, because they snuck their way through the cultists. There's a lot of cultists left alive. So if they do meet the dragon, he's going to be like, come to my aid, cultists. So that's left me in quite a good position. And that makes sense in the world. The players aren't going to feel cheated that a bunch of cultists have turned up because they went through a room with 10 of them in. So yeah, it's not going to be a surprise if 10 cultists turn off in a bit. So I'm quite happy with that.
It's a bit of a dirty trick, and I know it is. Once or twice I've set up a boss encounter, and then immediately afterwards there's been another, just a medium encounter, but because they thought, oh, this will be the last one, most of their stuff's gone. So they're using the spell slots, their potions, things like that. And I was like, oh, you go into the next room where the actual treasure is, and there's 12 more dudes in there. I was like, okay. Okay, we'll think about this.
Yeah, when they're redlining, that's when it's so close to the end. Yes, that's a good shout, actually. Yeah, that's a nice little trick to have in the tool belt for those situations. But yeah, I can... Those players are at a level now, like level 11. So they've got Tiny Hut. They've got invisibility and fly and all that kind of stuff that does trivialize a bunch of encounters. So I'm, in a sense, I've got a lot more wiggle room to throw harder stuff at them or easier stuff at them when I want it to be easier, because I know that they'll trivialize it in a sense. But just, yeah, it is just an art rather than a science and experience of putting stuff together and being like, oh, okay, 5 Sturges was a TPK for a level 1 party, even though they're just flying little insects with 2 HP was a TPK. Okay, let me take a closer look at the next encounter I throw at them, because that is going to be a different experience. So yeah, everyone gets gone over with a fine tooth comb, and there is a weird satisfaction to being like, what if I tweak? It's almost like my programmer's brain in me is like, let me take out one salamander and replace that with like two fire giants, or a fire and a fire giant. How does that change? But that's got resistance, so let me see how that's gonna that doing that kind of micromanagement. I mean, it must be working out, because the players are having fun and every encounter is quite memorable. So a little bit of upfront management, but now I'm just torn between an adult red dragon or a young red dragon, and I'm not sure how that's gonna go.
It's hard one with that, because you're right, you want it to make sure it feels like a big challenge. If they walk through it too easy, it's not as fun.
Mm-hmm.
Also, yeah, you don't want to kill them all.
Yeah, I've got a phase of an idea for it being a two-fate. Like, I abuse video game tropes as much as possible where they make sense. And I do want it to be a two-phase fight. So in my head, it's like they're in the hall, so he can't fly as well. And when he gets to like 50 HP, he's going to be like, do you know what? I don't know. Why am I fighting you little ants in this hall? I'm going to go up. And they're on like a volcano, red dragon, obviously. And then they'll go up to like the caldera on the top, which is going to be epic with, you know, it's exploding.
Magma spewing, yeah.
Yeah, he's flying around, and that'll be the last half of his HP flying around there. That's my best laid plans.
Yeah.
How much of that actually transpires, I do not know yet. Yeah, we'll see. I've not actually run a dragon, you know, just like a dragon fight before. So even with X years experience, I'm still quite anxious about, you know, obviously that it's in the name of the game, right? It needs to be epic. So I'm a bit worried about how well that will come out. They had the opportunity to fight one previously, but that was a green dragon who was all tricksy and manipulating, and they chose to be friends with it rather than fight it. So I was like, okay, that's fine. I was like, hey, I gave the opportunity to fight a dragon and you said no, so don't blame me that it's 4 years before you get
another. Yeah, that's totally fair.
Yeah, that was super fun to be like, hey, I you know, bent the rules with like magic casting, and the dragon took human form, which I think rules is written it can't or whatever. So, but that was super fun to be like, welcome, have dinner, sit down, join me at the table. Oh no, I'm totally a massive green dragon, but come and join me for dinner. Let's talk about things. And I'm definitely not lying or cheating, or I've got like crossbows trained on you from my from my allies. Like, don't worry about any of that stuff. That was fun to ooze lies.
Yeah.
But because they're so tricksy, it'd be very hard for the players to work out where's the truth end and the lie begin. Another part that we're gonna go very literal now. So for translation, obviously there's a 9 billion different languages now in D&D 5e. There's common, and then if you scroll through a list of available languages, that's just bloated out of reality. From like, you've got Aquan and the languages that only I had them in. They're like they're kind of like bronze dwarfs from the Plane of Fire whose heads are on azers. They speak one flame elemental language. So that's a good example, actually. They met some of those Azers, and they're like, oh, do they speak common? And I'm like, they speak a sound of metal scraping on metal. Oh, do any of you have that in your in your languages you speak? So even that, so for all the DMs out there, even for a level 11 party who didn't have comprehend languages or anything, or tongues or whatever it is, that was a complete showstopper. That was a complete like, oh, this is the first time in a long time we're talking to intelligent creatures that we're just going to have to gesture to and like scribble diagrams in a book and see if that has anything in it. And it was very like, oh, we can teleport around the universe, but I can't actually speak to these creatures.
So, as part of this same arc I was doing with the undead gnolls and the witch and everything, they came across a scrap of paper, which was like a note to this witch, but I think it was written in Abyssal, which none of them spoke, but some of them did speak some of the infernal languages, which uses the same sort of script for it as far as D&D goes. you know, I was like, okay, well, here's a good opportunity. Let's see how well you roll for this and see how well you can actually translate this piece of paper. And, you know, that's when the Nat 20 comes out and I go, okay, well, this one I prepared with half the words is no good. Now you just have all of the words normally. But yeah, translation in terms of like English and Spanish, for example. There's this great story I heard of a DM at a school who one of the players, English was their second language and they were a bit uncomfortable or unconfident as partaking in the games because they didn't know everything that was going on. So we tweaked the game to be, well, in this world, then Elven is Spanish and you only speak Elven because you're a highborn elf and that's, you just never talk common. So now she has an opportunity to interact with the other players who are a bit more bilingual, ask the questions in Spanish and also learn more English and still roleplay as her character really well. And I was like, what a perfect use of that kind of function to flesh out a character, flesh out the world and make it much more inclusive as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a drawback for me, being my ignorant British self, is I don't speak an iota of many other languages, apart from, you know, two beers, please, is as much as I get when I go to a country.
Where's the library?
So that's you know, very much a failing on my part. So I'm robbed from those, being able to have those kind of experiences, and I'm reduced to sounds like metal scraping on metal, or pretend you can't hear this next conversation we're about to have rest of the players. which is a shame, but that's the nature of the games I've found myself in. However, saying that, one of the guys is Polish in one of the games, so I might try and crib that idea for something going forward. I'll be like, go ahead and speak Polish and watch the rest of us be bemused for 50 seconds.
One of my very occasional players is quite fluent in French, and the city that they're mostly partaking in is French-Spanish styled inspired, with their own sort of sub-dialect in there. So yeah, whenever she does come to a session, I make sure I pepper some of that in there, just for her to like, oh, that's I could do this. And then she'll rattle off some French to me and I'll go, well, I can't do that, but...
Sounded great. Yeah, that's useful and interesting. Have you had any other fun, either, because obviously the other side of things, not just speaking to NPCs, but like written books or signs on the wall or languages they can't read. Have you had any fun with that in your games? And as I said, we're going very literal with the word translation now.
Yeah, of course. There's been a few puzzles. I like to get quite prop worky with my puzzles and things like that. So there's been a few bits and pieces like that. But yeah, common seems to be like the predominant language that everyone speaks in for my players, and they don't really speak much else.
Okay.
So I try not to put too many in that because I've got no spellcasters really. So no one's going to learn comprehend languages anytime soon and things like that. So there's no point in giving a puzzle which is just dumb luck, brute force, keep trying and hope something sticks, or abandon it and just leave the whole thing. So I try not to do too much of that, but I will put in a few. Usually it's more like, if you can read this, here's a cheat for what the rest of this puzzle is, and if you can't read it, there's other ways of solving the puzzle that don't involve the language, but you just get a bonus if you do know it.
That's a little bit surprising, because most of my games there's all I'll be like, does anyone speak Aquan? And then there's always one that's like, oh, actually, yeah, I do. It's common, dwarfish, and this very, very alien language. Okay, fine.
Just in case.
I guess the rules have said that you can learn that at some point. So I mean, as a DM, I sometimes am like, kind of make a justification for why you speak this
dead language. Exactly the same with that. Yeah, you can have it, but tell me why you know it. Were you a bookish child?
Yeah, that's one of the odd things that stands out during character creation for D&D 5e, at least, is that, like, oh, and one extra language of your choice. Oh, here's the list of 50, some of which
don't exist anymore. Aren't spoken on this plane, only spoken by certain races, you know, whatever.
Yeah. One creature in the Dungeons Master's Guide has it, and it's now found its way onto this list, and some like newer player doesn't know, go, oh, that sounds interesting, blonk. Oh, there aren't any Vidalcan in this campaign, so I guess your language of Vidalcan is now like
absolutely
redundant.
Worthless. Just a sort of sidebar on that, I always thought that with you know, the original version of Ranger before they changed the rules, and I think it was Tash's, where it's like, oh yeah, pick like three different environments in which you excel at, and then you can, oh sorry, we're taking place entirely urban, there's no snow here whatsoever, so that's a whole waste of a level for you.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. But yeah, no, I'm surprised that my guys now don't have tongues or comprehend languages, because they used to have a warlock who would have done that, and then he found himself in the Shadowfell moping around betrayed for a bit, so they lost that ability. But yeah, usually there's somebody who's got some way to effectively, mm-hmm. even with like message, you know, telepathically yeah. or something like that. Yeah. I think they still need to understand and you still need to have a shared language, but there are other telepathy spells that allow you to bypass that completely. So that encounter was very interesting, but I'm surprised for you that you don't have like no one. There's always somebody who's picked alien or whatever the language is. That's
I know. You'd have thought so, but no, not really. I mean, you know, common, dwarven, elvish. One of the players is a goblin, so she knows goblin.
Yeah,
I can't say too much about another player in case the other players hear about it. But she speaks a couple of languages that so far they haven't come up yet. I'm wondering about giving them something that lets them translate, but making sure that only the most chaotic player can use it, just because it'd be really funny.
Yes. Oh, I'd love to see that item's description, like how it's locked down to just the only the person with the illest intents can use this item. Yeah. Oh, you could. It's a proper. What is it? Rabbit's foot. Whatever it is, the term. Monkey's paw. I was in the right area.
I knew what you meant, though. Actually, it came to my mind.
An animal's appendage. You can translate any language fluently, but to tell other people, you have to lie. Like that's the curse. So you know absolutely what it is, but when you try and communicate it to somebody else in a language they understand, it has to be a lie. You have to be lying.
Have to lie to tell anyone else. Thank you so much for that. I'm definitely taking that.
That's quite all right. I'm just astonished that came to me just then. Yeah, that is hilarious. And if it is a proper cut, like one of those hidden curses that doesn't reveal itself until they actually go to do it, they'll be like, let me stand to the front, let me translate. I'll be translating.
Oh, yeah, you'd be really excited for it. And then they turn around to the exact opposite or something like that. Like,
let me tell them. Ah, you tell them that they have no defenses and there are no guards here. Oh really? Yes, that's what you say to your
party.
Oh, that's the Machiavellian. And of course, I'm in love with it.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, my mind is now very much in DM, like thinking of ways to use that.
So I've got a game coming up Wednesday, so this is good for me. Like, this is going to get me working for it now.
Because then once that penny has dropped and the other players have appreciated that, then you're into some weird like meta game of trying to work out where the lie is. And is it like everything's opposite, or are they white lies and are there actually loads of guards? Or which is a fun little thing in of itself.
I was something like that. Actually, I might text the person and say this is what you say out loud, or this is the conversation you have. Just so, again, keep that sort of mask of what the players can hear and what they're being told, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, that is one of the trickier parts of the game, because obviously it's human nature to be colored by the things you hear, and it takes a lot of self-discipline and practice to be like, I've heard that. But I need to pretend I haven't. Yeah. But even pretending you haven't colors your future interactions. Yeah. So absolutely.
I've done a couple of like dramatic scenes with like one or two players, and I've had everyone else leave the room because it's focused just for them, and I still want the setting for it. But having just a general conversation between one player and some random guard, you can't have everyone leave the room every single time that happens.
Yes, I've had it before, and this the stuff that really tests me as a DM is I'll be DMing direct messaging. To be clear, I am. Yeah. Let's keep it obvious. You know, one particular player who's like, "Oh, can I? I want to try this. Or does my character know this? But I don't want the other players to know." So then I'm like, "Yeah." And then the character that you're talking to is, you know, playing with their hair while I'm rattling on the keyboard to the other guy, trying to have that discussion as well in secret is testing, but often some of the most fun things.
In the second campaign, my wife played a rogue, and she said to me, like, when we get to this loot room, can I try and steal like half the gold before anyone notices me do that? Which should have been a bit of a red flag for me, like for our relationship generally, but but yeah, I said it. So every time they enter the loot room, she gave me two rolls and just sent them to me as a message, and I immediately subtracted a bunch of the gold.
That's the best way. I was gonna say, then you just tell the rest of the players, you found 1,000 gold.
And then tell her separately, this is how much you got instead.
Yeah,
and it came to they needed to buy something as a group, and she went, oh well, I've got like 2,000 gold. It was like, sorry, how? Just picked it up, you know.
All those pennies you've been dropping, they add up, you know, behind the sofa. So to bring it back a little bit then, so for the written books and stuff you've done then, you know, how much of that has been a unique experience? I've had a lot of people on the show before who have done Kickstarter, or in, you know, several people or have made businesses without using that. And obviously that's a very, like, a completely different side of the industry, a completely different side of the hobby. Certainly crowdfunding is a very different way of doing it. You know, I've, as I said, the stuff that I was writing, I was half in the mind of putting it on digital platforms just as a PDF to download. So I want to pick your brains for a moment around that the physicality side of it, getting, you know, I certainly in England as well, with like laws and whatnot, there must be something there that's different from publishing on dmskill.com or something. So how has that been for you, that whole experience from top to bottom? Because there must be other people out there that have gone, do you know what, other people have gone and appreciate this, but how do I do that?
I mean, yeah, being a self-published author is, it's great in a lot of ways, and it's a lot of work in a lot of other ways. Mm-hmm. You know, what I found myself doing sort of middle of this year was, it'd be an hour of work writing, then go to work, do work, come home and do like an hour of social media, plugging and emailing, building the website and things like that. So, you know, you're talking like 11 hour days before you actually stop what you're doing, really. But yeah, I mean, for me, I started writing this first book because I just wanted to get some creative outlet out. And then I got stuck at a point. I was like, I didn't know what to do next. So I just rolled a D20 to see whether or not they passed or failed. And then that became like the niche, the unique selling point of the book, is that the protagonists and the antagonists do that all the way through. And that, you know, that's quite fun for like as a journey for me, because I couldn't really plan out the ending because I didn't know if they were going to make it there. And all the fights seemed to feel tense because you're looking through a list of actual combat roles as well. So you can see how badly it's going for the protagonists or the antagonists as you go through. But yeah, I mean, I've got like one of my one shots is on the website Only Crits, who are some really nice people, and they're really nice. So we're talking about my book going up with them as well. But that was quite nice and easy. It's just, I've made it, here's the thing for it, and they've put it up there. I didn't have to worry about it too much. In terms of actually publishing a book, as it were, you know, the only thing I really had to worry about was in the UK, any new book that is published, you have to send a copy to the Great British Library within like 4 weeks. But otherwise, I didn't have to sign anything, submit anything. There's no legal things I had to worry about. I was quite careful with, you know, all the stuff that happened this year, last year, with the Open Gaming License Wizards of the Coast trial change, all that sort of stuff, is they've got, I think it's the system reference document.
Yeah.
And anything that's listed in there, I think you can't use because that's specifically their own IP.
Yes.
So I then went through a cull. I was like, right, none of the spells are called the same thing. None of the races are called the same thing, aside from, you know, they haven't got a claim on like Elf or, you know, Hobbit or anything like that. But I was like, yeah, right, let's have a complete change. So it has that feel, but I think legally I'm safe.
Yes. Yeah. No, I am not a legal person at all. And I hate, like, when I looked at the OGL and the system SRD and stuff, I was like, man, I can't. My brain isn't wired to like comprehend this in a way that I feel comfortable pushing it out without having lawyers kicking down my front door.
Yeah. I think luckily I'm too small fry to worry about that anytime soon. But yeah, it was a bit of a concern. I do think it's funny that they wrote up a new document for a group of people who collectively read documents and manuals that are like 400 pages long as a fun thing to do anyway, like
yes, yeah. Asking for trouble with that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I was working on some homebrew meme classes mixed with Always Sunny with a guy, and I do a first draft and he's like, oh, I can see you've put that spell and that spell, we can't use those. I'm like, oh god, right, okay. Don't know what to do now then.
Yeah, it does become that bit of back and forth of what can be done and what can't be.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So is there anything you wanted to discuss that we might not have hit yet?
I think actually we did sort of cover everything I'd had prepared. You know, you actually came up to actual translations before I got there.
Ah, great minds. I was wondering if you had that in your bag of holding there to discuss.
Yeah. I suppose the one thing I didn't touch on, I suppose, was translating one genre into another. Ooh. So like for my books, for example, the first one is, you know, quite thrillery, but it's definitely fantasy, but there's a lot more thriller to it. The second one is definitely still fantasy, but a bit more action adventure. I've tried doing this with this third campaign, is we've gotten rid of Constitution and made it Fortitude, and given it some skills as well in there, which are about like getting through like harrowing effects on the body, or, you know, specific tolerance to poisons and things like that. And I'm trying to draw in a bit more like Cthulhu, a bit more horror into it, which is, you know, a forest full of undead gnolls with crystal ball controlled witches and stuff like that. It's, you know, it's quite an interesting thing to do. I know obviously there's horror aspects to D&D as well, but I wanted to try and dial it up a little bit more, because I think from what I've played and done and seen of 5e, it is always more the high fantasy first and action sort of a secondary thing. So I was trying to inject a bit more horror into it. So I thought that was quite a fun way of how do I take this great thing that Cthulhu does and make it into D&D in a way that doesn't ruin the game at all.
Yeah, completely balk all the balancing or like checks and everything. Yeah. I had that repurposed hospital actually was my like horror dungeon that I wanted to have, that feeling of like, you know, you're creeping through dusty moonlit corridors with like a gurney just rolls out from a room, just squeaking wheels, that kind of stuff. And that was I find with D&D 5e, because you have that sword and sorcery is so thickly laid on everywhere, you do have to go just as thick with the other tropes to really be like, to communicate to the players, okay, this is
actually creepy. It's not just normal creepy.
Yeah.
Once you get up to like level 11 or something like that, you're like almost demigods anyway. So things become a lot more, as you were saying, you know, they've got fly and levitate, things become a lot more trivial. They don't have to worry so much about stuff like that. So I'm gonna try and inject as much horror whilst we're all still at level 3.
Yeah. And that took forever to design that dungeon and then really lay on thick, like a bolt of lightning, you know, arcs outside and flashes like a flashlight in the room, and there's a skull in the corner, and hey, like, it's DM's prerogative, let me live a little.
Yeah, why not? I mean tropes like that exist for a reason, because everyone sees them and recognizes that.
So that was fun. And also aided the dungeon design, because that, again, like I said earlier on, like starting with it making sense. So I was like, okay, well, what rooms are going to be in at the hospital? And you're like, okay, well, there's going to be like waiting room, there's going to be operation rooms, there's going to be recovery rooms, there's going to be like outpatient rooms. And then from then I kind of build my way back to like, where would they be, and then what kinds of encounters would they be in there, and what would they find? And then suddenly, before I know it, I'm like, oh, that's the first, I ran out of space on this first floor, what would be on the second floor? So that's how I tended to approach that. But I'm trying to think of any others. The rest of my dungeons have been routine, like caves, tunnels, kobolds, goblins, dragons, that kind of stuff. But that one in particular was very fun to be like, you're in Spooky Town now, guys.
Yeah.
Let's all appreciate how spooky it is.
Yeah, let's take it appropriately.
Anything else that you wanted to discuss? I around that genre piece, that's a good shout, because I hadn't thought of it at all. So if you got anything more on that, then I'd more than welcome the discussion.
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah, I wish I had more. I know I'm now looking downright, because my brain is now rattling through other things I want to try and do in a similar vein. But that horror one was probably the easiest one because of how commonplace the tropes are. Like,
yeah.
The squeaking wheels is like classic or 101.
But I mean, you think of like traditional horror stuff anyway, you know, there's demons and devils and monsters all exist in D&D, so it's an easy pull to bring in. But if you're going to combine like sci-fi in there, like I know obviously there's what was it, the Sunlit Citadel or something like that expansion model, and I know it looks like they've done a pretty good job of porting that across while keeping the feel. But if you suddenly drop a lightsaber or a plasma rifle into the world, everything's just going to go wrong. Well, it's going to be hard to kind of mesh that feeling without just feeling like it's out of place or something like that. So I think, you know, and inherently there's action and thrills and stuff like that anyway. I suppose just going through like a murder mystery might be quite a fun, more role play heavy piece to go through, you know, just, there's no one to fight, there's nothing to do, it's just plug away and see if you can work out the clues. But I think that relies a lot on investigation checks and things like that anyway.
Yeah, well, for any DM out there, remember the rule of three for that kind of stuff. I've talked about it a lot in the podcast before, so I won't go into detail again, but that is, if you're doing anything investigatory, rule of three at least.
yeah, that's pretty.
Well, that pretty much brings us to the end of today's discussion. Is there anything you would like to promote?
Yes. So obviously I have my book, Dead Surprise, which you know, you can find on Amazon, you can find in cool merchandise in, if you're in the UK. It's in Waterstones if you want to order it, and hopefully it's going to be in a few other places as well. If you want to see more about me, I've got Facebook, The Lands of Ferrox. I've got Instagram, Lands of Ferrox. I've got a website, acwickham.co.uk. And yeah, I do a subscription email through my website where I try and do, like, you know, here's some tips for how to do this or how to write in certain ways, or here's a fun item or a NPC you can have. So I, you know, I think it's worth signing up to it, but you know, I'm writing them, so maybe I'm biased.
No, absolutely. All the links to the website and the socials will be in the episode description, so please do check out there. The only thing I have to say then is thank you ever so much for joining us on the show, Austin. That was fantastic. It's good to get back to it and have a chat, and also, you know, someone local relative to the rest of my guests. I do really appreciate it. So thank you for coming on the show. Thank you to everyone for listening at home. As usual, everything's in the episode description. Please do check us both out. I would very much gladly have you back on the show again to talk more about our endeavors.
I'd love to come back. Let's talk about the fact that players never seem to get through a door first time around.
That's good. Nice. We'll cover both spectrum of the words that we'd have on the show. So thank you everyone to listening at home. That's bye from myself. Goodbye. It's goodbye from Austin.
Bye.
And we'll see you on the next episode. Now it's time for the Patreon shout outs. Huge thank you to all my patrons, starting with Josh, Leewanika, and Glenn, the three fabulous hosts of Tabletop Journeys who've been on the show several times before and who I'll always invite back. So go check out Tabletop Journeys at ttjourneys.com or at ttjourneys on Twitter. We also have Joe from the Fourth Leg podcast all about giving DMs another leg to stand on. Again, previous guests of the show, and I'd thoroughly encourage you to go and check out their great content. So you can find them at The Fourth Leg on Twitter. We also have a good friend of the show, Optional Rule. You can go and find him out on optionalrule.com or at Optional Rule, full of very insightful and educated comments and thoughts and threads on the really nitty-gritty of D&D. We have what a guy, Matthew Perkins, who is just out there in the world trying to make you laugh. So go and check him out at MatthewPerkins.net or at Hey It's Matty P, MATTYP. And good friend of the show and one of my table mates, Matthew Street. Go and check out his partner's hustle at virtualtimehustle.com or at MPStreet88 on Twitter.